my friends, real bad into MMOs, and I was not in on it. And I was like, what is your guys' problem? This game doesn't even look fun, and it's all you are committing your lives to. And I don't even play it with anybody else. I'm just like, I wonder what the lore of the game is like.
Yeah,
and
that would be me. It's like the idea, the biggest, I could would probably have end up playing it at least a little bit if it weren't. The strong suggestion was that you were going to join some sort of guild and play with other people and like hang out at. Apparently, there are like in-game like strip clubs.
I haven't been to one of those yet. Okay, we have to stop for a second. Hi, I'm Nick.
And I'm Kyle.
And this is the Big Bang Theory, where we talk about the television series The Big Bang Theory, but we don't really enjoy it that much, and so often we just talk about other things we like, and then we kind of just sum up the episode and move on to it. But right now, what? So I am not done with the first main scenario of the game. Matter of fact, I think I'm at the end of bosses, and there's one of them that seems to one-shot me with his super second phase move, and so I don't know if there's a trick to it, or if I'm just supposed to get better armor. But I haven't run into a strip club yet. What? Tell me more.
I remember reading about this, I think, in a Kotaku article, because it's like one of the biggest drivers of the in-universe economy of Final Fantasy 14 is there's no nudity, obviously, in maybe not obviously, maybe unfortunately, and a missed opportunity. But there is, in fact, no nudity in Final Fantasy 14, but there are dance emotes. And
yes.
So there are places you can go, servers, I mean, not like hidden or illicit servers, but there are, I think, 18 only servers in...
I could be on a horny server?
In Final Fantasy 14, so there are 18 only servers where there are cities and guilds you can go to where most of the economy is driven by paying, people with attractive in-game skins to do dance emotes over your character.
I hate life. I don't want to be a part of this.
This is what you said. Was it not obvious when you were playing the most Japanese of all MMORPGs that this is what you were signing up for?
It's just... So, and this is where I disconnect from the real popularity of MMOs is... I don't like playing video games with other people. I play video games to get away from interacting and to recharge my batteries.
So same.
Yeah, and so the reason that I'm able to kind of accept 14 as an MMO is I don't have to partner up with people, except for there are these story dungeons, which are one of the more fun parts of the game, and for that, it automatically partners you with others, but always also automatically gives you a balanced party, so you don't actually have to communicate with each other. Everyone just kind of does whatever their role is, and unless someone is actively trying to screw things up, which has never actually happened to me, it goes fine. And so...
And you can just turn the chat off so you don't have to listen to what they're saying?
I don't even know. I don't think the game even has voice chat, as far as I know.
Oh, well, that's obviously a plus.
Yeah, and so... But I'm starting to enjoy it more with the idea of... In the way that I like numbers going up, I've hit the point of the game where the numbers are going up at an acceptable rate. And I feel very comfortable skipping most of the little dialogue, which I don't know if they paid, like, a handful of novelists to work their magnum opus into this. Because I'm not even saying it's bad writing. It is just too much, and at the same time, nothing. But the idea of wanting to interact with others, or decorating myself to impress others, the weirdest thing I've ever seen, and it wasn't even that weird, was, there are these hubs in the game where... You teleport around, and they're super convenient, so you're going to run into the most other players at those. And when I first started playing the game, someone would just sit in the hub, and their character on a lute was playing Taylor Swift music. And I didn't know if they have that set up automatically. If that's someone sitting at a computer, just strumming through Taylor Swift songs on their imaginary lute... But that was one of those moments where I'm like, life really doesn't mean anything, does it? It's like, you can do whatever you like. It doesn't matter. This guy, I assume, found some sort of bliss in this. I'm marveling at it while I'm also disgusted. But yeah, I guess that's the real appeal that they have that is just not there for me. It just isn't. I just want to see what happens when I hit level 50 and then what happens when I hit level 55, and then wouldn't you know it, what's going to happen at 60? That's my appeal.
Do they still, is it a class-based game, I assume? So what class are you?
Yeah, so it has a job system. You can change jobs, but every job, as far as I can tell, I mean, it's almost like you're doing a different character. Every job has its own independent level, so it's not like you can be a level 30 monk and then be like, well, I want to try being a ninja now. No, you start over at level 1 as a little baby rogue, and then you turn into a ninja. How do I know that? That's what I'm doing. And I think there are more advanced classes later in the game. But yeah, I started playing as a pugilist, who then becomes a monk. I got to the one-shot kill boss, and I was like, you know, let's take another crack at this and see what happens if we try being a rogue this time instead, because that sounds fun, and that evolves into a ninja. And so now I'm doing my ninja training to see if I can understand this game better to beat the boss, when really I probably just have to grind for better armor.
Fair enough. I will say the only it's weird because I will never play this game, and I'm quite sure of that, but I know exactly what class I would want to be in the game.
Tell me.
The job. Red Mage. Always been my favorite of all of the Final Fantasy classes. And mostly just the aesthetic. Like, the classic red outfit with the pointy hat and the particularly the rapier. Just think it's a stylish look. Very dashing and cavalier. And, you know, it sort of represents my ideal sort of play style in any RPG, which is I don't want to have to make decisions about loadouts. I want to be able to be at least a little bit good at everything. I don't have to be very good at anything, but it would be nice to just be a little good at melee combat and offensive spellcasting and defensive spellcasting. If I had all of those, then, you know, I could be all by myself.
That is 100% the opposite way how I feel about them, except for the agreement on their sick style. They do look good. It frustrates me that the gameplay part doesn't appeal to me as much because, yeah, they always look fly. And the rapier is, I don't know why, it's like my default favorite weapon of starter weapons in any game where it's included. If I can just poke something a bunch, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, because it's a cool, it's, you know, it feels like a real sword. It doesn't. Well, I don't know. You're right. It's still, you're basically like a cool magical musketeer dude.
Yeah. God, we're being too much ourselves right now. We should talk about this television series.
Yeah, about nerds, not like us.
Well, Colin, so, as you already know, I did a goof. We usually record on Saturdays. You sent me a message saying, let's do it Sunday at 4 o'clock your time, 5 o'clock my time. And I said, Shekaroo didn't register at all. Well, the time did, but then I got the time zone backwards. And so I just set up my computer, like, I wonder if Kyle's okay. Something is amiss. And then realizing I had the time and day wrong, which means I watched our episode to prepare yesterday. And so I've had a day to kind of stew on my feelings. They're not as strong as they were yesterday. Kyle, yesterday, I loved this episode. I laughed out loud twice. I thought it was a good Big Bang episode. I thought it was realistically nerdy, even though I was a little disappointed by the ending. I guess we can actually talk about it, but I just wanted to get that right out there. I had actually positive feelings about what we're about to discuss here.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was fine, I guess.
Yeah, that's more reasonable.
I thought it had a, I will say this, a realistic amount of character conflict, which is something you don't, like, well, character conflict that both feels plausible and interesting at the same time, which is not ground that the Big Bang Theory manages to land in very often.
No. Well, let's get into that then and read from the unofficial official.
And it did have one moment that made me laugh really hard, which may be one of the moments where you laughed really hard too.
Oh, so we can I'm eager to it. Learn this. Oh, I hope we line up. Otherwise, the podcast is over. But so the short summary reads, after Emily meets everyone, she is not cool with Penny because Penny hooked up with Raj. The guys think about investing in Stuart's comic book store to help him get restarted after the insurance settlement was not enough. Also, so first, let's talk about this. My issue number one, even though I like this episode, I do not think being naked in bed and maybe even a little smooching qualifies as a hookup. I feel like hookup implies full pen. I could be wrong about this. Kyle, what are your thoughts?
Well, that's this feels like a soft retcon to me, because I thought I don't remember any point in that episode where they do end up in bed together, where it was explicitly stated that they didn't round all the bait, go all the way.
So I think you're right. I have no recollection of that. You know, what I thought was, wasn't it like they got drunk and they ended up in bed together and naked?
Yeah.
But that it was kind of a misunderstanding and they woke up like, did we have sex? Probably not. Huh? And now they're just kind of assuming they must have? I don't know.
Well, no, now there is, so you assumed in that episode that they had not had sex. I had assumed in that episode that they did have sex. And then I guess, the show splits the middle ground, which is, they made out naked, but that in its, you're telling me they got all their clothes off and got into bed. I mean, forget about whether or not you call that a hookup, but you're telling me there wasn't even hand stuff?
Yeah. Or, you know, what I kind of would assume is that maybe Raj would start like getting handsy, and that's where Penny is like, No, I'm a makeout slut, but Leonard would get mad, and then there could have been a scene about Raj being like, well, he's gonna be mad no matter what, so let's just keep going, and then they have to have a more awkward conversation. But
or they just, I mean, also possibly if they were both blackout drunk, they like, you know, they got halfway, you know, they got to the stage where their clothes were off, and then they just passed out, which I think is a thing that happens with in blackout drunk makeout sessions quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't know. It's almost like if a tree falls in the woods for me, if two people are completely blackout drunk and have sex. But who knows? You know, yeah. I guess we read it differently.
That's the official policy of most fraternities.
Hey-o! But yeah, so that we read it differently, but that is the base issue with, you know, what is the A plot? But I also think, once again, the B plot is a little bit better here. A lot better, actually.
I mean, I guess it's the other thing that's, it's weird only in the fact that they're bringing it, because I sort of wondered if that was one of those, I thought it was weird that they never ever talked about it, because, you know, all the times when Raj is doing the whole woe is me, I could never get well, but there was that one time I hooked up with Penny. So it's weird that they never brought it up, and now they're bringing it up again. But anyway.
Yeah, I guess maybe they look for sources of conflict, and they're like, is there anything we can base this on in our varied and diverse lore? And then they remember that they were naked in bed, and maybe there is full pen. Who knows? That's the province of God. But
to answer your original question, no. When I hear two people hooked up, I don't assume necessarily that they actually slept together. I do assume that it was more than just like they kissed a couple of times. I think I imagine like third base.
Okay. We won't even get into the bases. That could be a whole other podcast. But all of this is to say that the main conflict of this episode is Raj finally decides to bring Emily, if you've forgotten, his girlfriend, over for dinner at the apartment. And it's mostly fine, except that Emily's a little cold towards Penny in what I thought was actually decent acting, where she
agree.
She's Emily does not in any way come off as mean. She is just a little distant in a way that most of the rest of the crew doesn't seem to pick up on at all. But Penny's like, I just got a weird feeling. Ugh. And I can't remember if she even initially suspects it has anything to do with Raj. I think
she has no idea what's going on there.
Yeah, whether she's too pretty or something. And then,
to be honest, that's what I thought it was going to be. It's just like some weird...
Me too! I thought it was like, Raj can't be around a hot lady. Get out of here.
I mean, I think they may have... I believe that was actually a plot in another episode of the... I think one of Leonard's girlfriends had that issue with him and Penny. Although in that case, it was also the fact that they had actually dated. Although I guess that's basically, yeah. So I don't, anyway.
Who knows? But yeah, so it's not evil, not awful, but a little off-putting scenario. At the same time, while trying to kind of power through it, Penny's like, oh, hey, you are a dermatologist. And there's a scene, part of the scene where everyone's like, hey, I've got this ailment on my butt if you want to look at it. Sheldon in particular. And Penny is like, I am now in the pharmaceutical industry. Could I practice on you doing my sales pitch? And Emily is open to it, but again, she seems a little off. Penny then follows up to meet her in her office. And Emily, again, not being evil, but is obviously feeling... she's very short with Penny. Like, she, even though they set this up, she really doesn't seem to have the time for it. She doesn't think Penny's jokes are funny, which I liked her joke about. She's trying to advertise some birth control and how one of the side effects is acne. But, I mean, if that's one of the side effects, doesn't it make the birth control that much more effective? Waka, waka, waka. Emily gives her nothing for this. It's dead silence. I felt for Penny in that moment. And so I think she reports back to Amy about the terrible interaction. Amy's like, you know what? You're a charismatic cutie. Why not just try selling yourself? And Penny says that's really stupid. But, that, you know, ultimately, it kind of goes that way. More, they talk it out, I guess. And that's fine. Where, I think Penny learns that Raj is the one who told Emily about their hookup.
Well, she does. I think, and this was another one that I thought is, I thought the way in which, again, just surprisingly, like, not particularly nuanced, but like well-written and reasonable and actually how you would do it in real life. I thought the way Penny confronts, what's her name?
Emily
was pretty good, which is she's just like, I'm sorry. I'm getting a weird vibe here. Did we get off on the wrong foot? Did I do something to upset you? Cause you can tell me. And that's how she finds out.
Yeah, no, it was again, people acting realistically. So yeah, that is the reason.
And then you have the whole, I'm a little upset cause you guys made out, and Penny says, like, what, like, is, I think, a very reasonable philosophical response. It's like, well, that doesn't really count for anything, does it?
Yeah, well, that's where I had a hard time relating to Emily being upset. I can understand thinking it's a little weird or uncomfortable, but to be like, oh, you guys had fooled around at some point, so you either are evil for being an ex, or you're like a threat because you're still around. I don't know. It's not like I don't think it's totally understandable to be like, oh no, a babe that he used to make out with and they're still friends. That is a little risky. But that she is immediately like, well, and she's not. She, again, is personable but a little cold. But in her mind is thinking, fuck you, you bitch, I'm going to murder you. You know what my boy's wiener looks like. That's only for me. And so they do, just have a talk. They work it out, sort of. I guess the ironic twist on the conclusion there is that even though ostensibly they decide that they're okay with each other, as Emily is leaving Penny's apartment, it cuts to a shot where you could see both of them on either side of the front door going, oh, I hate her. And so, you know, maybe they'll have a slap fight. Maybe they'll have to make up from that slap fight. That's what I'm hoping for. Probably not. And then the other plot, which I think this is what I liked a lot more, is that the nerds learn that the comic book shop might not open up again. Sierra's shop. They're now shopping at the popular shop that they hate that was featured exactly one time before. But now it's their only choice. And they're like, well, what can we do to help Stuart? And there is another... I guess it's like halfway through this plot where they are all talking about whether they could put up the money for it. And, you know, who's a good partner and who's not. And Sheldon's like, you know, maybe Amy and I don't have a romantic relationship, but I'd know well enough to consult with her before I spend a whole lot of money on a comic book shop purchase. And I was like, hey, Sheldon, good on you for this one. But the thing that bumps me out is, like, long story short, they all want to invest. They each argue with their partners about it, either a little bit or a lot. And then it doesn't work out because it turns out that... that there is a running thread about Wallowitz worrying whether Stuart is banging his mom or whether they're besties or whether he's being replaced. You know, any one of those possibilities. And that with that, Wallowitz's mom gave Stuart the rest of the money to get the comic shop back. And so they don't actually need to put it up, which bummed me out because I thought that would be like a good season-long arc of the nerds actually try to run a comic book shop and how that goes. And maybe this is my own nostalgia here, but as a guy who once worked in a comic book shop, I both got hired because I was told that I didn't have the weird kind of nerd fanaticism that would put people off. But at the same time, I was only there for the comic books, and I always begrudged that the store was kept afloat by magic cards. And so I was imagining scenarios of these nerds trying to have it their way and then butting up against being either too impersonable to deal with a regular public or, you know, not making it financially feasible because of their own weird tastes. But all of that is a pipe dream, Kyle, because instead it kind of works out, except that Wolowitz is still concerned that Stewart's banging his mom.
Which I think he still has a reasonable right to be concerned about.
Yeah, it's so... I don't think it's happening, but they're getting more and more intimate.
I mean, how much money do you think it costs to open a comic book shop, to renovate a comic book shop? I mean, I was thinking she gave him at least like $10,000.
Oh, at least, yeah. I can't imagine it was anything trivial. And that, you know, part of the joke too is that Wolowitz comes over to his mom's house / his previous house to talk with Stewart about it, and Stewart's like, oh, hey, could you call first? You know, we like it when you come by, but... And Wolowitz getting very hurt that he may not be as welcome in his own home as he once was, while dirty Stewart's grabbing all over his mom. But, I mean, that's really all the contours of the episode. I'm a little sad, because you're going to have to tell me what made you laugh the hardest. While we were going over the broad points, I can't remember what specifically really made me go, ugh!
I will tell you the exact moment I laughed out loud. It's Penny is soliciting advice from Bernadette and Amy, and she's like, yeah, I just feel like Amy or Emily was a little cold to me and maybe doesn't actually like me that much. And she's like, and Bernadette is like, why did she say something to you? And Penny's like, well, no, but I mean, people don't do that. They don't just tell you to your face that they don't like you. And Amy goes, wow, you and I have led very different lives.
That was good. So I did remember one of mine. I don't think it was that one, but I did enjoy that. One of my laughs was just the idea, and this wasn't an actual plot element at all, which is why it hasn't come up yet, but when the nerds are kind of fantasizing about the kind of comic shop they could have, one of the ways that they want to get it more popular is like, you know, what if we were active in the community and reaching out to youth?
Oh, I'm laughing now thinking about this.
Yeah.
I guess I did think it was funny.
Yeah, because, you know, we want to bring in younger people and show everyone it's family friendly. It's like, well, how are we going to do that? I don't know. Like, what if we, like, got in a van and went to, you know, grade schools and playgrounds and, like, tried to tell people about how great comic books are, get them to come check out the shop. And what I love is that there is just zero awareness at all to the child molester angle here, except from Leonard. Leonard has just that degree of social awareness to point it out, and he's like, oh, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. What are you going to start handing out candy to? And Sheldon is just like, well, I am now. That's a great idea. But, yeah, just the earnestness that, I mean, and to be honest, in a world where there aren't sexual predators, that wouldn't be a terrible idea. But unfortunately, the specter is ever looming. And you can't just go around, you know, pooling up kids to take your cool comic book shop anymore these days. Society's truly fallen. The West must rise again or something. Yeah, I don't know. Overall, pretty good, though. You thought it was fine.
Would you say it's a realistic portrayal of female conflict with all of your expertise on this matter, Nick?
So I listened to a kind of semi-educational podcast earlier today, and the topic was the science of breakups. And when they gave the tips on breaking up, I was like, well, I feel like I have done the exact opposite of every one of these and have some things to reconsider. So I want to add that as a caveat to my expertise. But yes, it's, I'm not a woman. I've never had to fight with another woman as a woman. I've never had that weird layer of jealousy. You know, I've dated, you know, ladies who their ex is still around or they're friends with or whatever, and I haven't had this kind of conflict, but I also understand it's not exactly the same necessarily between the sexes. But yeah, everything to me about their interactions and their conflict and how they dealt with it and how they didn't resolve it but are just going to live with it, pretty realistic, I thought. I thought it was conveyed very well. What did you think?
Yeah, me too. And then also I thought, the only thing, and this is not, again, the show is not required to be 100% consistent, and maybe people really like this, but I do remember Emily was introduced as the one who was cool with Raj dating two people at the same time, because, you know.
Oh, I forgot. Yes, Kyle, thank you. Sir, continue.
That was it. So, and also, she's the one who's, like, watches horror movies and get super horny when she watches them. So just in my experience, people like that are not particularly possessive of their partners, but you know, whatever. Oh, it worked for this plot.
So Kyle, I'm glad you brought that up, because you have had the better half of the experience. Like Amy says, you and I have lived very different lives, because whenever I have been in kind of a, we're just fooling around, this isn't serious, we'll kind of see other people relationship.
The Zoomers call that a situationship.
I've heard, yeah. That's I have a hair lady now. You know, I don't think she's a barber. I guess technically, hairstylist, whatever you want. And whenever I go to get my hair cut, it kicks ass because she already knows what she's going to do and I don't have to ask. And she always updates me on her situationship. And I was like, oh, that's fun. And then, I mean, it doesn't actually sound that fun for her. It sounds like she really needs to move on and it's not working out. But I've been in many a situation where, yeah, it was like, no, we're just, you know, we're sex pals or whatever. Until you start seeing another person actually, and then it's like, oh, wait a second, I thought maybe we were doing something more serious. And it's like, oh, I thought we explicitly talked about not doing something more serious. Where is this at? And so, I can see it both ways.
And to be clear to anyone, I don't know that anybody would be judgmental of Nick, but just as his protective friend, I want to be clear. Nick is a giant teddy bear, and it always overcommits first. So if you're worried that Nick was the one who was making the relationship ambiguous so that he could play the field, I guarantee you that has never been the case even once in any of the scenarios he's describing.
Well, thank you for defending my honor and confirming that I am definitely not the one getting the advantage in these situations. But yeah, I can see it either way. This is just coming off the top of my head. I guess it's a criticism of Emily as a character so far, which is, I think she's very believable. She's not particularly funny yet. She doesn't have a funny quirk like
that's true.
Everybody else. I hope that develops.
Probably means she's not going to stick around, unfortunately. Like, she does not... I feel like they're still looking for, like, the fourth girl in to complete, like, the girl. What is a four? What's one more than a trinity? You would think I would know this. Tetralogy?
I guess yes. So. Maybe they're so rare is why I've never... I think you're right, but I've never thought about that.
Yeah, I think it's a tetralogy. Anyway, they've really mastered sort of, I think, the Penny, Amy, who's the Bernadette dynamic. And
yes.
They're just so hesitant to add a fourth that might upset that. And so, but yeah, I don't think Emily's going to be the one to go the distance on it. Just shame. Oh, that reminds me of the other. So I guess I was just really into that scene, but Amy's advice, because she doesn't agree with Bernadette's advice, which is just be winning, is Amy's like, well, maybe you just pretend like you're her friend so long and so aggressively that eventually she'll forget that she didn't even like you at the beginning and just sort of accept that you're always around and that you're close to each other. And Penny, I don't remember what Penny says, but I think it's some form of skepticism. And Amy's like, yeah, you're right. What do I know about this? Anyway, let's get some more wine.
No, that was good. I'm just a totally normal friend that everyone has always liked. And Penny does realize, like, I used to not like you, didn't I? But, I have friends like that who started off like very abrasive with each other. And then it's just kind of like, well, through exposure alone, I guess we love each other now. God damn it. And everyone all has right, to send a list guessing who those are.
I think we've sufficiently covered the
episode. I think you're right. I feel ready to move on. And, you know, I think I've got my recommendation, even though it's not a super strong one. Kyle, do you have one ready? Do you want to go first? Should I? How do you feel?
I mean, I'll go ahead and go. So, first off, I saw Dune 2. Or I guess not Dune 2. Dune Part 2. Which does make sense to say. I mean, it sounds a little pretentious, but it is the case that it's the same book being covered in one part and two parts. And I will also say, unlike other times where it felt like they split it arbitrarily, this made the way they split these two movies up makes perfect sense. And it is like, yes, you did this the right way. And it's really good. Epic knife fights. Also, did you know Christopher Walken's in it?
I heard he's in it and that he has a shockingly measured performance.
It is wild. Not only is he in it, but he does. There's like one or two times, if you're really listening to it, he breaks into like the Walken cadence. But he is mostly like, you could almost believe that he is not Christopher Walken and that he is in fact a character in this universe. Which, considering who's playing, like, that is just a monumental achievement. It just makes me wonder if the reason he doesn't do that is just in either every other movie, the explicit instructions have been like, no, don't be the character, be Christopher Walken, or he's just been so contemptuous of the material that he's been like, fuck you, I'll do my thing, thank you. But yeah, knowing this, he's like, I am the Emperor Padishah the 14th, and you will kneel at my feet. And he's like, oh shit.
Maybe that's how he's always felt, and this is the first time he's felt comfortable in a role.
Well, as people pointed, so random fact that sorry, this is going way out of left field. I'm about
please
to
go
to
on.
Dark, but you remember a couple years ago, there was that who was it, Moby or someone else? But anyway, Christopher Walken was in a music video where he danced around a hotel.
Fatboy Slim, yes.
Fatboy Slim, Weapon of Choice. Do you know that song is also actually about Dune?
Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that till now, but yeah, if you walk without rhythm, you won't attract the worm.
Right, that's apparently the weapon of choice is actually his, in the song, it's my voice is my weapon of choice, which is also a Dune reference. And so,
I never thought about it, but also I guess I didn't know Walken was in this until, you know, yesterday or 2 days ago.
I didn't know that about the Fatboy Slim song. But TikTok pointed this out to me, and it's like, it's all coming full circle, baby.
This is what it's like when worlds collide, which is another song that's not in Dune, has nothing to do with Dune.
Anyway, so yeah, good movie. If you like the first one, you'll like this one. If you haven't seen the first one, you probably definitely need to do that. Or this
Sense. Well, and that's like, I had real mixed feelings about the first one, and I'm wondering if seeing the second one will retcon any of those feelings. So I'm going to try to check it out this week.
It definitely feels like the first one, in retrospect, was just 99% setup for this one. Very satisfying setup, but like, it's all world. That movie is like all the world building and heavy lifting, so that this one can be like all the cool knife fights and battle sequences.
Okay, I'm down for that, because that was a problem I had, especially like at the ending. I was like, that didn't even feel like a cliffhanger.
And Javier Bardem looking at Timothée Chalamet like he absolutely just wants to bone him so hard the entire movie.
That's not even acting. That's just Timothée Chalamet. That's beautiful little man. Who I forget is like a real adult and not a forever boy. I mean, he's a little sexier than Tom Holland, who I think really is like a Pinocchio, but...
Yeah, no, I get it. It's like he... Anyway, he's going to be a weird... He's going to be like the Culkins, which is like he's going to be a weird 40-year-old, you know?
Yeah. Also, it sucks. I hear the new Wonka movie is good. I still don't want to watch it, but I hear it's good.
I heard it was better than all of the other one, like all of the other shitty, like cash grab franchise prequels that we have been getting. I hear it's better than all of those. I still haven't actually, no one has gone so far as to say good yet, but
okay.
You know, your mileage may vary. I'm not going to watch it, but you can go ahead.
I'm not interested.
Anyway, but no, so I feel like there's only one thing I can... It's not even really a recommendation as so much as a retrospective, which, Nick, feel free to jump in here, although I know your relationship is pretty, one data point on this. But Akira Toriyama passed away this week. Arguably the most influential comic book writer of the 20th century and artist, because he, you know, he drew all of his own stuff. I mean, that's a, you could argue a lot of different people could be in that category, but I mean, if you actually look at the scope of his work and how many people have access to it and were influenced by it, he's like, you know, you don't think about it, but he's probably up there with like Walt Disney in terms of just like how many people. I guess what's weird is, unlike Walt Disney, who did a bunch of different things and had a bunch of different franchises, with Akira Toriyama, it all really comes back to mostly one thing. Although actually Nick is a video game nerd. Feel free to jump in on the other stuff it also comes back to. But yeah, so in the late 80s, early 90s, Akira Toriyama was a guy who was mostly famous for having created a very popular, in Japan but nowhere else, well, that's the thing. Before him, you know, manga was mostly just a Japanese phenomenon. And he had created a very popular, silly manga about a robot who could run super fast, you know, and had super strength and got into wacky adventures. And that was called Dr. Slump. And even there, I didn't realize, but apparently, I was watching, you know, this was just on Twitter, but there seems to be some shockingly compelling evidence that even that was more influential than I realized, because apparently, like, those running animations and the logo and stuff bleed into Sonic.
Oh.
Like, the entire aesthetic of Sonic the Hedgehog is maybe influenced by Dr. Slump. Like I said, I have no way of knowing if that's true. But then he wanted to move on to his next project. And, you know, he was still mostly known as like a guy who wrote, you know, silly kind of juvenile. And by juvenile, I don't just mean for kids, but I mean, you know, a lot of like fart jokes and such for, you know, for like 12-year-old boys. He wanted to do his next thing. And so he decided to make a silly adaptation of one of the great works of Asian literature, Journey to the West, which is sort of like this long epic poem thing about a monk who travels, you know, across the known world, which in China at that time was basically just China to India and back. So the story was about, you know, this guy traveling from China to India and back, and along the way he meets a bunch of wacky, you know, zany mythological characters, shapeshifters, you know, fox spirits, and most famously a monkey god.
Rides on a cloud and has an extended bull rod.
Yeah, yeah. Probably influenced by the Indian deity Hanuman, Sun Wukong in China, or in the Japanese version, Sun Goku, who is the monkey king who was kicked out of heaven because he was just causing too much shit up there, and so now travels the earth, you know, getting into crazy adventures with his incredibly, you know, monkey-like personality, but his Hercules-like, godlike physical strength, and just, you know, teams up with this monk and, you know, goes on adventures with him. And so Akira Toriyama was like, well, that's cute. What if I made that guy the central protagonist and it was just about him and, you know, some other person going around the world on some quest? And that became their quest, it was decided, would be to find the 7 legendary Dragon Balls, which when united would allow you to make a wish. And so that comic book was, of course, Dragon Ball.
Wait a second, that doesn't have a Z at the end of it.
Well, yes. And so Dragon Ball was originally a silly adventure manga, but as it went on, for whatever reason, I literally don't know like how much of this was editorial and how much was this was his own choices, but it became more and more about martial arts and fighting. And then eventually it went from kind of having a silly tone to having what was now still feels silly, but at the time was kind of considered a deadly serious sort of martial arts tone. And yeah, and eventually that escalated and, you know, it went from having mostly a fantasy sort of vibe to it to more of a science fiction vibe. And it became about, you know, aliens and clones and robots and stuff. And you know, it got a very popular anime adaptation, which was divided into two parts. The Adventures of Young Goku, which was called Dragon Ball, and The Adventures of Goku when he was a grown-up adult, which became Dragon Ball Z. And the first arc of Dragon Ball Z was one of the first anime to ever be optioned in the United States and translated basically uncut. I mean, it still had, and mostly with all of like the source material and like a rough accurate translation in the United States. And I remember being like 6 or 7 years old and watching my Saturday morning cartoons, and in between like two other cartoons, like I didn't start at the beginning. I just remember randomly turning it on and being in the middle of the Saiyan arc, which is the arc where Vegeta and his big brainless hulking sidekick bodyguard Nappa come to Earth and they just kick everybody's ass, and half of them die until Goku shows up and kicks their asses and drives them off the planet. I just remember being blown away by, like, I mean, again, I was probably 5 or 6 years old, but just like the drama of it, because there are real stakes, because again, in like one of the first episodes I ever saw, one of the characters who was ostensibly seemed to be one of the main characters just sacrifices himself to save a kid and just gets blown off the scope of the, and just flat dies. Like, there's no ambiguity. He's just like, he basically gets shot by an energy blast and he just dies right there protecting this kid as like his surrogate father figure. And I was like, that's intense. And then, yeah, turns into this big epic martial arts battle, the scale of which just blew my mind. And I was basically immediately addicted to this. Well, I was obviously not the only one, because it was so popular that it basically was, I think, the first anime to get fully licensed for a full, you know, translation in the United States. And it, I remember coming home after it was serialized on Cartoon Network. I would come home every day after school and I would watch, you know, whatever the newest episode of Dragon Ball Z was. And I was, again, not the only one. It was a lot of people.
It is incredibly popular, yeah.
Yeah, incredibly popular in the sense that, like, you know, I meet people from across an entire array of social and ethnic backgrounds and classes, and we, you know, often we have nothing in common, and then someone will just be like, you know, but you know, Piccolo, right, who's a character in Dragon Ball Z, Piccolo's a badass dude, and I'll be like, hell yeah, Piccolo's a badass dude. I mean, I remember, I think I have told this story on the podcast before, but I remember deciding finally as like a 32-year-old adult that I needed to go to therapy and being very nervous and anxious in therapy.
You gotta go to a therapist about your therapy. Ho ho.
Yeah, and trying to like lower my guard enough to like have a meaningful, like meaningfully let the therapist help me. I would just explain to him, like, you know, this is very hard. It's not like, it's nothing personal. It's just like, I feel weird talking about someone else to my problems. I feel like, you know, I mean, I don't think I'm like a monster or anything, but I'm just like a weird nerd, and I don't expect you to understand everything that's going on in my head, because it's like 90% of it is just anime references anyway. And yeah, and you know, and he just, I remember this guy was probably like at least 5 or 6 years older than me. He was a Hispanic man. I mean, he was a licensed therapist. He was obviously a well-educated man, but you know, he was just completely different from me in every way. And, you know, so far I'd been a consummate professional, and he just sort of nodded sagely. And then he reached under his desk, or he reached off screen, and he set on his desk what was clearly, like, line of sight for most people, a full-on statuette figure of Goku, the character from Dragon Ball Z, that he kept near him at all times like a talisman. And that was the moment I, you know, at the time I was like, I can trust this man with his darkest secrets. And I think that's just, yeah. So most of the last few days, it has been very sad, but it's also just been this incredible outpouring of like all of these, you know, the African American community and, you know, nerdy white guys like me. And, you know, I'm just now learning about, I guess this makes
sense. I like how you had to specifically call out the black nerds, because I too was thinking about, man, black nerds love anime.
They do, and they love Dragon Ball Z more than... In fact, again, the character of Piccolo, who's like this green guy, he was basic... I don't know why. I think because he's like the tallest character, and he has a very deep voice, and also he, you know, he's a different color than all of the other characters on that show. He was just sort of like adopted. Like, they just decided he was black. Like, there have been many discussions I've seen where it's like, yeah, we know he's actually green and an alien, but Piccolo is one of us. And they're just, like, very clear about that. But also, apparently, I didn't realize how big it was in the Latino community. But I've been reading all these stories of all these different Latino creators and artists and being like, no, when I lived in, you know, when I was growing up in Mexico, like, my town only had one channel, but every Saturday, like, everybody, all the kids in town would gather around, like, whoever had, like, the best TV, and we would all watch Dragon Ball Z together. So it was a legitimately worldwide phenomenon, and I think that's why I call it the most, because I think it was probably the first anime to ever go worldwide. And because of the way that there was just less anime, you know, 20 years ago than there is now by a large extent, it may be the only time in the history of the world when there was one anime that basically everyone on the planet who was, or every boy on the planet at least, who was of a certain age was watching together. So sure, it's nice to have this bond with all of my fellow boys. We respect you and we miss you, Akira Toriyama. Thank you so much for all you did for all of us, you know, your silly wacky stories keeping us company and teaching us that, you know, whenever times get hard, well, you just need to do 1,000 more push-ups and maybe, oh, and that's the, like, I don't talk about it much, but I'm, as Nick will attest, I'm kind of a martial arts and fitness fanatic, and that's gotta be where that comes from.
That's so, the first thing I thought when I saw that you were wearing padded clothing, so.
Yes. And also, again, for the, you know, that's the main thing. But also, if you're a fan of, like, Dragon Quest or Chrono Trigger, if either of those video games are very important to you, then I think it is pretty obvious that they would not exist without his artistic direction. So.
Yeah. Well, Kyle, I saw The Favorite last night, and it was fine. I don't have nearly of a compelling, heartfelt thing to say. I watched The Favorite.
Is that the one where Emma Stone, like, jerks off a guy, like, while looking as bored as possible?
That is the one. That was a great scene.
And then later on, she has to, like, finger blast Olivia Colman, but she looks kind of, like, disgusted by the whole process.
Kyle, that is correct. The Favorite was, I guess, so far, I don't know much about this Yorgos Lanthimos character, but he makes, I guess, critical darling weird movies, and I hadn't seen any of them until I saw Poor Things a couple months ago and really liked that. But everyone told me over and over and over and over and over again how great The Favorite was. Then I saw The Favorite and it was great, but just the amount of hype that was given to me, it didn't live up to that hype. But yes, the shortest version here is that there's Queen Anne rules over Britain, but she's old and sick and doesn't give a shit anymore. And so Sarah, her number one aide, effectively runs the country. And that's going more or less fine until, yeah, Emma Stone's character shows up, who is someone that was once nobility, but was fallen, whose father sold her to some German guy when she was 15. And so she's basically been a sex slave for however long and is now trying to... Oh, but she was also a cousin of Sarah, the queen's aide. And so she comes into the queen's court to be like, hey, can I have a job? And then pretty soon it becomes obvious that she is a nefarious ladder climber. And so it's kind of a little dance around, you know, what it's like to have between... Oh, and this, I guess I totally skipped over. Sarah and the queen also totally bang. Sarah is married to a prestigious general, but whether it is out of genuine love or just to get the queen's favor, she's totally going down on that broad. And then
a lot of lesbianism in this movie.
A lot of lesbianism.
Not that there's anything bad with, like,
it's against America. Women shouldn't experience pleasure, and if they're pleasuring each other, that just creates an anti-masculine Ouroboros that I can't tolerate. But no, it's, I think it is very interesting in the way there is a questionable dynamic that's fairly obvious, but that, you know, still not concrete about who genuinely is interested in who, what is worth giving up for the sake of lust, And what is it like?
Does anybody in this whole story actually care about anyone from but themselves?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a very interesting way of looking at all of that. But, you know, at the same time, like I said, it was overhyped. And Poor Things is just so bizarre to me, especially visually, that when this, even though it is a ridiculous movie, it is explicitly a comedy film, but it is so much more grounded than what I expected. That, I think, was a little let down. But no, still a great movie. And so that's my recommend. But yeah, more likely you should go out and, I don't know, spill out some 40s for Toriyama, because that is a tremendous loss.
I will say, I appreciate this movie. I mean, I liked it. I really liked it when I saw it. If you want something weirder, you know, obviously you could watch The Lobster or Killing of the Sacred Deer, which are both explicitly supernatural. I mostly appreciate this movie because it put Olivia Colman on the world map.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess everybody knows who she is now, but this was the first movie that made that, because, well, I don't think this was the movie that made that happen, but I mean, it was just like,
oh, I think maybe it was. It's because,
well, it's the movie that got her, like, it's the reason why now it feels like she's in everything, because
yeah.
She was in this movie and she was so good in it that she immediately won an Academy Award, and then she was basically in everything for the next, although she was also, at the same time she was in this movie, she was also on Fleabag, where she was great in that.
Oh, the evil stepmom or whatever she is.
Yes, so she was turning out a lot of good work. But you want to talk about a weird, you know, none of the other characters who were in Peep Show went on to be Academy Award winning actors, although maybe they deserve it too. Maybe Mitchell and Webb need another shot at a Steven Spielberg picture or something?
I still give the
guy who plays Super Hands.
I give Webb the benefit of the doubt, but he may be mildly transphobic at least. And David Mitchell, I love, but he also gets on my nerves. But Super Hans,
he is very smug.
He needs his own universe. Super Hans is infallible and beautiful. And even, like, he's the only one I've ever seen in another movie, and it's when he's in Bronson as, like, the super, like, effete other convict guy.
Is he the guy who gives Bronson his name?
He is. That is exactly him.
I don't think I realized that.
He's great.
I mean, I remember that character very, because it is a very, even in that movie, which is full of very particular and weird performances, he gives a very part, but I had no idea that was the same guy. That was
same guy.
Bronze.
Only other thing I've seen him in, though, and he kills it in both, but yeah, the Peep Show people all deserve more than they have. And yeah, when Olivia Colman suddenly became a star, it was, you know, sometimes famous people, they work their way up and you're like, ah, God, that doesn't seem great. But her, it was like, hey, it's about time. She kicks ass and this is wonderful. Well, after that, let's just awkwardly wrap up. I don't have anything fun. Go watch more anime, specifically stuff with people with shiny bulbous heads that are fighting all the time, that is more influential than anyone could ever possibly understand at this point.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever wondered why every other anime is about people, you know, randomly changing hairstyles as they get more powerful, that's where that comes from.
That, okay, so that is my Toriyama fact that I didn't understand until maybe my late 20s or early 30s make the connection that when Sonic the Hedgehog turns into Super Sonic, it is explicitly a Dragon Ball reference.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's, I knew Super Sonic before I had any familiarity with Dragon Ball, and when the two finally clicked, I was like, Sonic is an anime? I've been an anime my whole life. Sonic is an anime, everybody. Episode title.